Now, it might surprise you that religiosity is on the rise in the world. You might have thought that more and more people are becoming atheistic or agnostic or whatever derivatives they might be in terms of a practical atheism. But I was pleasantly surprised to learn in my studies this week that, as I've said, religion is in fact on the rise. And it's not always good. In fact, it is mostly evil, really. There's an article that I have here before me, written by a woman by the name of Harriet Sherwood. And it is entitled, in the following way, Religion, Why Faith is Becoming More and More Popular. And this is how she writes. Quote, if you think religion belongs to the past and we live in a new age of reason, you need to check out the facts. And here's the facts. 84% of the world's population identifies with a religious group. Members of this demographic are generally younger and produce more children than those who have no religious affiliation. So the world, not just because of a change of mind, but also because of pure population growth, the world is getting more religious, not less. Although there are significant geographical variations. According to 2015 figures, Christians form the biggest religious group by some margin. And I just want to interject my reading here by saying, don't go on the stat when it's talking about Christians. Because not everybody who bears the name Christian, and I've labored very intensely behind this pulpit to prove to you that not everybody who bears the name of Christ is actually a Christian, right? But just for the sake of statistics, let's just bear with Sherwood here. Christians form the biggest religious group by some margin, with 2.3 billion adherents, or 31.2% of the total world population of 7.3 billion. Next come Muslims at 1.8 billion or 24.1%, then Hindus at about 1.1 million and Buddhists at 500 million. Now then she goes ahead and she subdivides among religious groups, because there are obviously differences among various kinds of religious groups. I'll just go ahead and read that as well. Almost all religions have subdivisions. Christians can be Roman Catholic, obviously the biggest group with almost 1.3 billion adherents. Protestants, Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Anglican, or many other sub-denominations. Muslims might be Sunni, Shia, Ibadi, and all the rest. And the same applies to Buddhism or Hinduism. Even geography has quite a significant role to play. And as she says, geography is indeed important in religion. Asia Pacific is the most populous region in the world and also the most religious. It is home to 99% of Hindus, 99% of Buddhists, and 90% of those practicing folk or traditional religions. Skipping ahead, 3/4 of religious people live in a country where they form a majority of the population. The remaining quarter live as religious minorities. For example, 97% of Hindus live in 3 Hindu majority countries, namely India, Mauritius, and Nepal. But in contrast, most Buddhists, about 72%, live as a minority in their home countries. There are 7 countries where Buddhists form the majority of the population. Now here's the big question, and this is what is vitally important as we now eventually migrate to our passage this morning. And she begs the question here, which religions are growing and where? This is a vital question to ask. And here's the answer. The short answer is religion is on the wane in Western Europe and North America, but it's growing everywhere else. The median age of the global population is 28. Two religions have a median age below that: Muslims, which is at 23, and Hindus, which is at 26. But other main religions have an older median age. In other words, it goes on older statistics, but it does not detract from the fact that religion is growing everywhere else but Western Europe and North America. Islam, for instance, is the fastest growing religion in the world, more than twice as fast as the overall global population. Between 2015 and 2060, the world's inhabitants are expected to increase by 32%. But the Muslim population is forecast to grow by 70%. That's a lot. That's huge. She goes on to say, and even though Christians will also outgrow the general population over that period, with an increase of 34% forecast mainly thanks to population growth in sub-Saharan Africa, Christianity is likely to lose its top spot in the World Religion League table to Islam by the middle of this century. This is quite interesting, these statistics that I just read to you. And I mean, she's not a Christian, she's just a secular commentator to world demographics, or whatever happens in the world, and in this case as it involves world religion. Now, why do I start this morning by telling you about the rise of religion? Well, here it is in Revelation 17, and that's where I'm going to ask you to open your Bible this morning. In Revelation 17, we learn about, this is now for a future generation of people, we learn that religion is indeed going to be the popular choice at such a time in the future. Now, I want to give away everything that I'm going to be preaching on here right in the beginning, but this passage mainly deals with, and this is my title for my sermon this morning, it deals with the rise of a one world religion. The rise of a one world religion. Now just having thrown that title out there, I want us to remember that it isn't too far-fetched for us to think about the possibility of the eventual advent of a one world religion. I think the world is very much geared and gearing towards being what they call a global economy or a global community, or maybe you have heard the phrase being thrown back and forth before, a global village. Now, in a global village, there can't be any extremes, right? There can't be, you know, the village hermit who has his own philosophy and his own religion and his own way of thinking and his own way of doing things. That can't coexist in a world where everybody is supposed to be saying the same things, eating the same things, doing the same things, and worshipping the same things. I hope I'm making sense by what I'm saying. And so already as we're sitting here, I believe there is a push, whether it be at the hands of political figures, motivational speakers, people of renown in the world, the rich people in the world, whoever, that there is a push coming from such individuals for the world to unite in a way that is just not going to happen, in a sense, right? At least not with Christians present. True Christians, I would say. Now there's nothing wrong with peace, right? There's nothing wrong with having a peaceful existence. That's not what we're talking about here. But what we're going to be reading about here is the dawn of a false peace. See? Now, we've already made a good dent in the book of Revelation. And at this point, if you've been with us since we've started this series in Revelation, then you will know that this time is going to be characterized by the rise of a one world government, or a one world leader, who is going to be walking ahead, he's going to be walking in front, he's going to be leading this world population or this global village, and all are going to be singing the praises of this one world government and leader. Already dealt in Revelation 13 with the rise of the beast. Remember that beast who would rise from the ocean and who would start to exert his authority over the inhabitants of the earth, or at least those who have been left behind. Again, I don't want to rehash everything that I've been talking about, but we believe as a church that possibly the very next thing that's going to be coming is the rapture of the church. We don't know when that is. Okay, it might be in 10 years, might be in 100 years. I hope not in 100 years. All right, but it can also be today or tomorrow or in a week. And therefore, we see the rapture as imminent, right? There's an imminence to the rapture of the church. But once that has taken place, once the rapture has occurred, then there are going to be some interesting things that's going to start developing on planet Earth. And I would say the most notable of these is, of course, the rise of this one world government and this one world leader. But that's not where it's going to end. Sure, there has to be a one world governance, right? There can't be any extremes, as I've made my point quite clear. There can't be that villager sort of country who does as they please. No, there has to be teamwork, right? It has to be a team player approach. That's on a governmental level. But there's also going to be massive cooperation and unification on a military level, okay? On a military level. In other words, all the armies of the earth are going to unite as well. And this is almost unfathomable for us, because right now we're cognizant of a war in Eastern Europe, right? So how can this all be? Well, I don't know, but the Lord has prophesied and the Lord has foretold. And that's what we're going to be learning about a little bit more this morning. Not only as we keep in mind that there's going to be this unity that comes on a political level, not just this unity that's going to be coming on a military level, even a social level, but also a unification of the world on a religious level. On a religious level. And that's fundamentally going to be the most powerful tool in the Antichrist's hands. Some here this morning might be wondering, why is he saying that? Because faith can be a powerful thing. That's why. I'm not talking about true faith. I'm not talking about true faith. People who believe in things. And I'm not talking about things that we can touch or see or smell or taste, right? People who have some idea or understanding of the world that we cannot see in a religious sense can be very fundamental and extreme in those beliefs. Just take, for instance, the Muslim who would be willing to strap bombs, I mean, you're talking about dynamite, around his chest and walk into a busy market square and blow himself and maybe hundreds of others along with them into eternity. Just to prove to you that faith can be extreme, right? Now, as extreme as that may sound, this is going to be the most extreme form of false faith that the world has ever seen. Hands down. Unequaled. You might think Islam right now is on the rise, and I read that to you to make exactly that point. It is on the rise. But the larger point that I sought to make is this, that it shouldn't then be so hard to believe that there is going to be one day this one world religion that's going to be reigning over planet Earth again, as people are being deluded, as people are being lied to, and as they slavishly follow the beast and ultimately, finally, worship him. That's where it's going to end. That's where it's all steering. Okay, so this is all about the rise of this one world religion. Let's go ahead and read these verses that are before us this morning. It's Revelation 17. Let me read to you from verse 1. But before I do so, let me put my spectacles on. Okay. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names. And it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon, the great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with the 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is to come." It was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind of wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. There are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they had over their power and authority to the beast. They hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." Phew. You almost want to just wipe the sweat off the brow a bit here after reading this passage. There's quite a lot here, isn't there? Now, before we get anxious about what everything means, I want us to start from the very beginning here. And what meets us here, or what we find here, very obvious right at the beginning of this passage, is this appearance of this harlot, or this prostitute, this woman, that we read about in the very introductory verses. And she is described as someone, in verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. Then, finally, in verse 5, her identity is revealed. Because there is a name on her forehead. There is an inscription on her forehead, which is this: Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. I've said what we're dealing with here today, in fact, deals with the rise of a one world religion. Now, here is the main reason why we believe that. Scholars of the book of Revelation, mainly again of the pre-tribulational sort or pre-millennial sort, have concluded that this woman is analogous to false religion. It's analogous to false religion. And there's a few good reasons why they have come to this conclusion. First and foremost, I think the very obvious reason would be because of this inscription on her forehead. Now, for one, yes, she's described as a harlot, as a prostitute, as a woman of, I suppose, very low morals, no morals, if you will. But then she has this inscription, right? This inscription that we read about in verse 5, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Now this in of itself tips us off, or it gives us a hint as to the identity or what this woman, the appearance of this woman in the book of Revelation really signifies. If you know anything about Babylon, then I suppose already you're starting to connect some dots here. Babylon in the olden days, or in ancient times, were really the hotbed or the very seat of false religion. And there is a very memorable history that involves the becoming or the founding, if you will, of Babylon or of false religion. And it is to be found in the account of the Tower of Babel. You will remember right there in the beginning, in the book of Genesis, we not only read about a massive flood that the Lord brought over the earth, and by the way, that was a worldwide flood. All the inhabitants of the earth died, save for 8 of them who survived, not because of their own acumen or their own skills, but rather because of the grace of God, who allowed them to enter the ark. That was the way of escape, right? By the way, and I've said this again, you know, I will repeat this again. The ark, which I suppose by the Apostle Peter, is used as analogous of the fact that God will again take us away, right? Before massive destruction comes over the earth. But this was real. This happened in real time. This was a historical fact. The worldwide flood. But eventually one day, whether soon or later, we don't know, the rapture might fulfill, and it's going to fulfill, a similar purpose. As God takes away the believing, takes away the obedient, that would be the church, and finally and ultimately brings massive judgment over the earth. But we're talking about the rise of false religion, right? And Genesis 11 details for us how false religion found its origin. And it's a very short and concise history, really, because it involves the descendants of Noah. Now, you would think that for people who have witnessed God's power, you have witnessed God's great strength in bringing all that water that would eventually amount in the flood, the worldwide flood, you would think that they would all be very devout and followers of Christ. Well, that was not the case. Definitely not. Because a few years later, we find how the inhabitants of the earth come together and they decide to build this tower, this massive high stone tower, in honor of their glory, in honor of their accomplishments, and obviously not giving the God who created everything glory, the kind of glory that He deserves. Let's quickly read about this history in Genesis 11 from verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. See, so that was the original sin that they committed. They wanted to make a name for themselves. In other words, the sin that lies behind this is the sin of pride. Verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they purpose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, Trinity, speaking here or dialoguing. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. This is where it all started. This is honestly where we find the history of all kinds of false religion and idolatry in the world. And I would say the defining mark or characteristic of false religion is that it is obviously man-made, right? It has man as its originator. And one of the key attributes or attitudes that go along with false religion is pride. It's pride. Now again, it doesn't take much to understand or to know that that will be part and parcel of what the Antichrist will eventually do one day. His efforts at bringing about a world religion and then finally, ultimately, applying it to himself, making him the object of worship, is perhaps the most high-handed effort at self-glorification. But it's no new effort. It's nothing new. It's been done before, see? And the father of this kind of, or of these kinds of efforts, is of course Satan, who lies squarely behind everything. Okay? He's the one who lies behind it all. Now a word must be said about a man by the name of Nimrod. Nimrod is not mentioned in Genesis 11, but he is mentioned in Genesis chapter 10. And he is described to us as a mighty man. In fact, his name signifies the fact that he was a true rebel and that he wasn't a follower of God. And perhaps, I suppose in that way, he lived up to that name, that he would, as an adult, rebel against God, perhaps walking in the footsteps of his forefather, Cain. And in some ways, I suppose he can be seen as a forerunner or an antitype of the Antichrist, if you will, of the Antichrist. We read about, again, this very short little biopic of Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10, there from verse 8. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, and therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Then we read about his kingdom, and we read about his acumen. We read about what he accomplished in his life. In verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Alright, so Babel had its origin in him, really. Perhaps it just came to a climax, finally, as a civilization, maybe as a false religion, and as a rebellious society, when they erected that massive tower in honor of their false religion and of their pride and their self-glorification. But enough said that that's where it finds its origin, in Nimrod. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Colna in the land of Shinar. And that's ultimately where it all started. Now, in spite of God scattering, and that's eventually how this all ends up for them, right? Because the Trinity decides to go down and to confuse their languages. And if you're not able to understand somebody, then I suppose you don't have a lot in common with them. So that ultimately resulted in their scattering abroad. But that's how God goes about doing it. But what happens is, and this is what we know about the development of false religion, at least in the ancient world, is that although they were no longer to be unified as a society or as a nation, all those things that they had in terms of their false religion and in terms of their rebellion, those were things that they continued to retain. And they took those with them wherever they went in the world. And the hotbed of that, or the nucleus of that, basically developing in the ancient Near East. in spite of God's scattering of the nations at Babel, the false religion kept going strong. Babylonian false worship spread over the world, especially as it received expression in worship of the goddess Ishtar. You might have heard of Ishtar before. Ishtar, who is seen as this mother goddess, moon goddess, whatever you will. And there are obviously parallels that can be drawn to the Greek world and to the Roman world, whether it be Aphrodite to the Greeks, or Venus, also known as Semiramis, to the Romans. There's great parallels that can be drawn with the development of this first ancient false religion and what eventually became the religion of those empires of the world, which is incredible. It seems thus that Babylonian religion was indeed the original false religion created by Satan himself. As Satan deceived people at the Tower of Babel, he will invariably, undoubtedly, again, deceive people during the last days. And this, dear listener, is the harlot that we're talking about. This is the prostitute that we are reading about here in Revelation 17. So back to Revelation 17. I know it takes a little bit of historical research and a little bit of exegesis in the Old Testament to get to this point, but it really does become a very easy passage to understand if we understand that this is all about the rise and the eventual fall of a one world religion. And as I've said, it is not very hard to imagine how this can happen one day. The world is very much ripe for a one world religion, or for a one world spiritual effort, if you will. And you often see expressions of that on the TV, where, you know, it's like a talk show, and they get a Muslim, and they get a Catholic, and they get a Hindu, and they get a, and then everybody's just kumbayaing, and everybody's just happy, right? You know, there are these efforts, and you see them repeatedly, whether on the television or you hear about it on the radio, and these are things that are glorified. Not so very long ago, it was postmodernism that reigned, wasn't it? And postmodernism dictated that all truth is relative, right? In other words, there is no absolute truth. That's what postmodernism tried to teach us, and it's false, and it's not true. It's unbiblical. But here we are now, and we're almost now post-postmodern, and we've become post-religious in a sense. When I say post-religious, I'm actually meaning that we've become a society that tolerates all kinds of faiths and religions. But not just tolerates it, but also propagates it and praises it. This is the world that we are living in. The kind of religion that this harlot represents might not be the kind of religion that you are thinking, but it is going to be a real world religion nevertheless. The Bible does not specify to us exactly what it's going to be. It might be its own unique false religion, much like the origins of Babylonian false worship, right? That's not impossible. But I'm suspecting, perhaps because there is such a big push for Christians, again in quotes, name Christians, to set their differences aside from, you know, those differences that they have with Muslims or with whoever else, and to come together and to perhaps acknowledge that this is their way of serving the one and only God. Perhaps this is how this religion is developing right now already as we are speaking. It's not impossible. Scripture doesn't say it, but it's not impossible. And here's one reason why I say this. If the world is going to be united, right, they certainly have to be united on all fronts. And by the way, when people come together, like taking for instance the European Union, they come together with their differences. With their differences. And some of those are gaping differences. So in order to unite does not necessarily mean that we're putting us, that we're forgetting who we were when we decided to come together and unite. Definitely not. But that's exactly the point. Perhaps this false religion is going to be the religion of come together. Come together. Let's set aside our differences. Let's stop waging war against each other. There is no holy war. All things have been revealed in our blessed brother, the Antichrist. And we can all be as one, right? How many songs have those as lyrics in them? Popular songs that I'm talking about. Okay? I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to imagine that that's perhaps how it could one day transpire. All right. So with that said, we now just looked at the rise of this one world religion. That was our first point. But John also shows us and he details for us the kind of influence that this one world religion is going to exert. So it has a developmental phase, perhaps now already in the world. But it's also going to exert a great influence over the inhabitants of the world, of that, call it that sample of humanity, that sample of mankind who's going to be left behind. And he's going to have to continue to exist at a time at which the Antichrist and the false prophet and this one world government is going to be exerting influence. But they're going to have great influence. Look, for instance, verse 6 onwards. John says, "And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come.'" All of this, all of these expressions that John uses, explains for us the kind of influence that he's going to exert. Starting there in verse 1, we're told that this woman, representing false religion, gets drunk on the blood of the saints. In other words, what this tells us is that this isn't just going to be a peace and love kind of religion. It's not just going to be that. And by the way, even the Buddhists, who are all peace and love, it's not just all peace and love. Alright? I can guarantee you that much. But of all the false world religions, this coming together, this grand corporate coming together of all the world's religions, perhaps unifying under one flag, there's going to be a lot of blood and violence. There is. I mean, this expression is quite vivid, is it not? She's going to be drunk with the blood of the saints. There's going to be a lot of bloodshed. As this one world religion keeps on flexing its muscles for the sake of the exertion of worldwide dominance as a worldwide religion. That she is drunk tells us that this religion is going to have a lust for immense violence. Now already there are some religions in the world that have these characteristics. I might get in trouble for saying this, and if I do, you're going to bail me out, okay? But Islam has that kind of reputation. It does. It's a very violent religion. Very violent. Now they might turn that on us and say, but so is Christianity. And in some ways, I want to say, perhaps false Christianity, yes, in many ways. But there are some pretty violent characteristics that can be observed in the religion of Islam. But that's going to be nowhere near to what we're going to see or what the world population is going to witness at such a time of the Great Tribulation, where this harlot, representative of false religion, this one world religion, is going to be exerting worldwide dominance. And she's not going to take it if people don't succumb. They're not going to take it.
these leaders,
the Antichrist and all his minions, and all those religious elites who are going to be the self-ordained spiritual sages of the world, they are not going to take it if people do not adopt this world religion. They're not. And if people don't, then obviously the only logical way to treat them or the way to deal with them is by execution or by making them of naught. John uses the word saints here, which is a plural in the Greek, and it is possibly a compound term which refers to both tribulation saints but also saints who have died in history at the hands of false religion. At the hands of false religion. I mean, here in the Great Tribulation, that's going to happen en masse. All right, that's when this harlot is going to get drunk on the blood of the saints, but like completely, you know, hungover on the blood of the saints. But the world has a very sordid history of the blood of the saints being shed throughout the annals of history. You don't have to look very deep in the pages of history to find examples of how Christians have been killed at the hand of, or at the hands of false religion. That's been happening. But here, during the time of the Great Tribulation, it's going to be happening en masse for sure. Now let's go ahead and continue on from verse 7. And we read again about the angel who's revealing all of this to John. And by the way, John is getting an information overload here, as we are. So we can just imagine what it must have been like to be in his sandals. But the angel said to me, verse 7, why do you marvel? Why do you marvel? Why is this extraordinary to you, John? That's another way of saying it. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and it is to come. Now in his astonishment, in his being gobsmacked here, John is being reminded here as to what the Antichrist will do, what will happen. And this is a reference back to chapter 13. Remember there, we read there about a mortal wound that he would be in, that would be inflicted on him, which he would in some way or another beat. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly what this is, but whatever it is, he's going to rise as the hero after that. Because he's basically going to be left for dead. It could be that somebody shoots him or something. It could be a staged thing, maybe, in some way or another, where it's this huge illusion that he creates that he actually was resurrected from the dead. And we read here that people are going to marvel at that. This is going to be fantastic for them. They're not going to be able to understand exactly how to make sense of this. That this person would have been dead, but yet rendered alive moments after. But all of this is going to be in the hands of Satan to continue to exert or to exercise influence over the inhabitants of the earth. I mean, just think about it. If we were to put ourselves in their shoes, right? Think in the future. We don't know when that in the future is. And Lord willing, we won't be there, right? Okay, none of us would have been left behind at that point. But you can just imagine if you were to put yourself in their shoes, if there's this one spirit that reigns in the world. Everybody speaks the same. Everybody eats the same. Everybody looks the same. Everybody talks the same. By the way, there's many Hollywood movies that have that as a plot. By the way. It's nothing new. And here's this world leader that rises, and he's this super charismatic guy. He's very intelligent. Whenever he opens up his mouth, it's all just incredibly profound and poetic and soothing to the ears and to the mind and to the thinking and to the creativity and all these things. And he inspires economically and socially and politically and governmentally and militarily. And he's just a gifted guy, right? There's, by the way, there's been leaders like that in the world. I always want to say John F. Kennedy was such a character. People loved him. Honestly, they loved him to bits. And he was assassinated, but obviously he wasn't the Antichrist. Okay? There are many examples of such leaders in the world who are able to get people rallied together, to get them swooped up, and to get them to marvel at his abilities, all of which are the doing of Satan. That's the kind of influence that he's going to exert. But this influence is not going to last long, because this passage finally results in the Lord coming into action. We've already read about that in Revelation 16, a few verses earlier. They're in the seventh bowl. And by the way, I never said this at the beginning, but chapter 17 and chapter 18 are basically a digression from chapter 16. We're dealing with symbols, we're dealing with digressions. What's next? Okay, pray for me, because I'm the guy who has to preach this. All right, but here's yet another digression that we have here. I think, if I remember correctly, it was 14 and 15 that were also digressions, or interludes in a sense. But here we have a similar thing happening here, chapter 17 and chapter 18, where chapter 16 focused on the judgment that was coming. 17 and 18 are now focusing on those on whom this judgment will come. See? Chapter 16 makes it evident God is coming in judgment. That judgment is going to be great. Here's going to be the result of this judgment. But chapter 17 and 18 show us, oh yeah, we're speaking of judgment here, but who are the ones who are going to be receiving this judgment? That's what 17 and 18 makes quite clear. And it's obvious. The receiver of the judgment, or the recipient of the judgment, is no doubt those who adhere to this false religion, those who propagated it, the originators of this false religion, this one world false religion, all of whom stood or will stand one day in the future, will stand opposed to God and revelation of God. Remember, I've said this over and over as we went through, or as we make our way through Revelation, I've said it. It's not going to be a complete removal of God's presence from planet Earth. It's not. It can never be. Okay, it can never be. It might be a little bit more of a governed sort of presence of God on planet Earth. People are still going to get saved. It's going to be the same way that they're going to get saved, by grace through faith, right? That's how people are going to get saved. And that in and of itself is testimony that God is going to be present. But largely because God is still going to be present, even in a governed sense, albeit, it just increases the judgment on the accounts of these people's lives for not worshiping the only true God, especially after seeing all these cataclysms coming over the earth, all these judgments, stars falling from the sky, famines, wars, earthquakes, huge rivers drying up, all of these which couldn't have just happened per chance, right? And yet people are going to walk slavishly after the beast, after the image of the beast, after the false prophet, his main jester, even amidst great revelation of God and his activity. Such is going to be this influence. But I haste. There is yet a third aspect that we see in this passage, as it involves this, the rise of this one world religion. And it is the fact that this one world religion is going to be extremely arrogant. Now this is already true of false religions. There's an arrogance in false religion. And the main arrogance that I'm talking about here is the arrogance of pride. The pride of saying, we have truth, when in fact it is false. See? It is the arrogance of saying, we know what is right, when in fact God has said the opposite. Okay? That is what we're dealing with here in false religion. And this is going to come to a crescendo one day during the tribulation, when this one world religion exerts its power, exerts its influence, and that's going to be the most arrogant thing that the world has ever seen. Now you think, as you're sitting here, you might have seen some arrogant people. You might have seen them on TV. You might have seen them at the office. hopefully not at home. Okay, but this is really going to be, this is going to be the epitome of all arrogance. This world religion will, as a unified military force, wage war against God Himself. You see, and that's the stupidity and the arrogance of this religion, is that it is eventually going to be unifying its powers all to oppose God. Read there with me from verse 14 on. Now after, again, the angel describes for John who is the woman, who is the beast, what is the horns. We can just reverse a verse or two. And the 10 horns that you saw are the 10 kings. They have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. They are unified, and obviously they have to be unified if they're going to amount to anything. Okay, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast, who is this, who is the pinnacle of the expression of their unity. And this is what they're going to do. All right, listen to this arrogance. Verse 14. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. I wish there was a little bit more between they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer. Now, if you wanted to insert something between those two phrases, insert all of the 7 trumpet judgments. Okay? They will make war on the Lamb, 7 trumpets, and the Lord will conquer them. I could have told you that was going to happen. You know? You almost wish you could go forward into the future and warn this sample of the world population that, look, what you're going to be doing and what you're going to be attempting is foolish. It's going to be the height of arrogance and pomp and pride. But it's been done before. And Babel was one little small effort at that. By the way, those people at the Tower of Babel, they knew about God. They would have known about God. Those stories would have been retold about the flood and about the devout who was spared and who was saved against the wrath and the judgment of God. And yet, I think it's 2 generations later, because Nimrod was the great-grandson of Noah. Okay? They committed this grand-scale collective effort at false religion against God. It's amazing. In spite of great revelation from God. And their end was dismal. And this future generation of unbelievers, of God opposers, of God haters really, their fate is going to be similar. Although God was a little bit more gracious toward the builders of the Tower of Babel, wasn't He? At least He just scattered them. Told them to shoo. But finally, at the end, this future generation, they're gonna meet the true wrath of God. They're going to come face to face with a God who is holy and a God who can be wrathful because of His holy righteousness. Okay? They're going to wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will conquer them. Why? It's obvious, because He's Lord of Lords and He's King of Kings, and those with Him are called and chosen and faithful. We continue reading. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they are the beasts." They and the beasts will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. Just one last reference here to the arrogance of false religion before we transition to our last and final point this morning is with regards to this reference here of the rule of the woman, or the extent of her rule. We find reference to that in verse 15. "The waters that you saw, John, where the prostitute is sitting, are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages." Now, what is true of ancient cities cities that developed in the ancient Near East is that they would have always had their origin next to bodies of water. I mean, that's just how it happened. And the more water you had, I suppose the bigger you could get as a city, because the more people could live there, the more people that could be sustained by that body of water, be it a dam or maybe a mighty river of sorts. whatever it is. So that invariably happened in the ancient world. But that's not the only reason why the angel is revealing this to John. Okay? It's going to be a mighty religion, and it's going to be situated in a very, very cozy position, if I can put it that way, where it can exert its authority. And for all practical purposes, it would make sense that it would be somewhere in the Middle East. I'm not saying it is, okay? Because that's a bone of contention for some. But I'm saying it would make sense for the Antichrist to rule from somewhere there in the Middle East, perhaps Jerusalem, right? And that fits very well with the interpretation of the city, right? The great city in chapter 16, verse 19, that was split in three parts, as if to say, that's going to be the focus of this great and final showdown. Perhaps it's going to be in Jerusalem. Why? I don't know all the answers, but I suspect Satan likes to mimic God. He likes to, I've said it before as we've gone through Revelation, he likes to mimic God in certain ways. And we see that in what the Antichrist will one day do, right? He's going to ostensibly be resurrected from the dead. Whether it be a fake resurrection or a real resurrection, we don't know. Bob can tell us. But he likes to mimic, he likes to counterfeit. And he likes to step on God's turf, in a sense. He did that right in the beginning, did he not? He stepped on God's turf when he entered the Garden of Eden. And he came to tempt. That's what he did. And so, I suppose it makes sense that, again, the culmination or the focus point of the battle will be somewhere in the Middle East, perhaps Jerusalem. And the fact that the angel talks here about the waters that this woman stands over, right? She is seated over all this great body of water. That represents, he gives us the interpretation there. That's easy. This is easy preaching. I love this. These are the peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. See, so it's all testimony of the extent of the rule that this one world government is going to exert. Like an ancient city who is over a body of water and who is able to do much. Was able to do great things. That's going to be the extent of the influence, but that is also going to be the extent of the arrogance. The two are synonymous. Lastly, finally, we also learn here in this passage about the lust that this one world religion is going to have. And there is a lust in idolatry, all kinds of idolatry. It doesn't even have to be an organized religion. That is, in essence, the definition of lust, is it not? It's a form of idolatry. But this is going to be the pinnacle form of all kinds of idolatry and lust. As this one world religion shoots its roots in the world population, sets up its kingdom, perhaps somewhere not in the ancient, but in the Near East, okay, and continues to exert worldwide dominance until all, or ostensibly all, are bowing their knees to their image. That's what this government is going to be attempting. The Antichrist will even get to the point where he will stop this facade, and it's really what it's going to be. He will stop this facade of a world religion and actually force people to worship. That's where it's going to end. Now, how do we do this? Well, verse 16 seems to tell us that. Read there with me. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, and devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. This is an interesting development here, is it not? You would think everybody would be happy, everybody would be pleased. The world religion, including the leaders and the princesses of the enough for them, obviously. It will not be enough for them one day in the future. It's not going to be enough for them. Because ultimately, the one who stands behind it, Satan, is only going to be satisfied with worship of him. That's what he's going to be satisfied with. Up until present, or even up until this point in the world's history, or the future of the world, I guess Satan has had to mask worship of himself behind false religion. He has to do that. Because otherwise, it's too obvious that it's wrong. That's why you don't find a lot of Satanists in the world. It's too obviously wrong. Okay? Who would want to worship the devil? And by the way, interestingly, there's even a rise of Satanism in the world. There is as well. But I suppose for most of us, we're not into the goth or the theory or the culture, I suppose. Satan is very easily hide behind false religion. It's very easy to do that. It's very easy to do that. And here in the world of future, he's going to succeed, number one, as a first point of contact, to unite all the peoples of the world behind the guise of false religion. Buddhist is going to be dark. You can figure it out. Okay? That's how he's going to present it to the world. But then the lust can no longer be contained to just be worshipped for who he is. See? And that's why we're also in the firm thing, exegesis, to believe that the Antichrist is going to be the embodiment of Satan himself in the flesh. About said it, he likes to counterfeit God, he likes to mimic God, he likes to step on God's turf. Jesus was the God-man, was he not? He was 100% man, 100% God. And Satan is going to try to do the same. Perhaps the Antichrist, that future Antichrist, is going to be so given to sin, so given to idolatry, that it won't be very difficult for Satan to completely, 100% control him like a puppet. It's not impossible. And perhaps this is what we're reading about here. These princes, these kings, including the Antichrist, will turn their back on this false religion. They will hate her, number one. They will start to hate her. Why? Because again, it is not full expression of worship of them, or of the Antichrist, or of Satan, for that matter. And so they will make of naught this world religion. They will crush it. They will stop it. They will cause it to cease. And then it will finally be outright satanic worship. That's what it's going to be. We read here the reason for this, verse 17. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out His purpose by being of one mind, handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. This is a very interesting insertion here in this passage, because even though we see this as the doing of the Antichrist, right? This is the doing of these princes, of these kings coming together with this lust for power and of worship of themselves. But ultimately, it is God who stands squarely behind it, interestingly. You know, the book of Revelation has a lot to teach us about the sovereign God. It's actually quite amazing. It really is. Because even where it looks like man is on his own, man is doing his own thing, man is just acting out on his own lust, it's actually God who is still behind the scenes, orchestrating everything, causing his perfect and beautiful plan to come to full fruition. It's God who's doing this. God has put it into their hearts to carry out His purpose by being of one mind. And then lastly, this is how this passage concludes. Verse 18, and the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Now we've managed to get through quite a lot this morning. If you feel anything like me, then you might want to hold your head a little bit, because This is more than one head can handle, I suppose. And that's why it's great that you're all here, because many heads make light work. Maybe not in this sense, I suppose. But if you have any questions, I don't often do this. If you have any questions about the subject matter that we've been dealing with up until now, or even maybe just this morning's, please come to me, and I'll do my best to try and help you. And by saying that, I don't mean to convey that I know it all when it comes to the book of Revelation. It's a difficult book. It's very tough. There's a lot there. There's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of imagery. But we do our best, and I hope at least you could have seen the main theme that lies behind today's chapter. Lord willing, we're going to dive into chapter 18 next week. I am probably not going to get far because it's a big chapter. It's quite a large one. But I've, off the record, made the promise that we'll probably be done with the book of Revelation in the new year somewhere, like January or maybe early February. I pray that that would be the case. But I suspect once we get to the Lord Jesus, then maybe we can add another 5 months. Okay? Because then things turn really, really positive in the book of Revelation. So please just stick with us. I know it's tough, it's hard, but stick with us. We're almost there. Let me pray for you, and then we'll send you off. Father, we want to thank you for this morning. Thank you, Lord, for bringing us all here. Thank you for your word, O Lord. Thank you for these words that are so rich and deep and full of meaning. O Lord, I pray that you will make us good stewards to decipher the true meaning, these words that you have given to John, this revelation. I pray, Lord, that you will give us understanding. And Father, that we will live our lives in light of the truth that we glean from this. Thank you for bringing us here. We pray that you will send us home safely. I pray that you will bless the picnic that we plan to have, a time of good fellowship and food and enjoyment. And we pray, Lord, that you will bring us back again next Sunday as we continue on in the book of Revelation. We pray these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.